This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Saudi ambassador to the U.S. travels to Pensacola to personally extend condolences for last week's tragedy at the Naval Air Base there. At the same time, the president comes under renewed pressure about his close relationship with the Saudi royal family. A new report about the Arctic raises more concerns about how far and how fast the climate is changing. And Boris Johnson has been to see the Queen. His election gamble paid off, crushing the opposition with his promise to get Brexit done. Plenty to talk about today on the Friday News Roundup. Joining us around the table, Nadia Bilbasi, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya. Nadia, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thank you for having me.
Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Hi, Dimitri.
Thank you.
And Robert Moore, Washington correspondent for ITV News, a network based in the UK. Robert, welcome to the Roundup.
Great to be with you.
Glad to have your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories from around the world. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. We begin in the UK with a massive election win for Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister. He has led the Conservative Party to victory, and his big majority means that Parliament cannot stop the country leaving the European Union at the end of next month, so Brexit will get done. Robert, let me start with you. There is a lot to pay attention to here, but what do you think is the top line headline from yesterday's election?
Well, look, undoubtedly the top line is it's a political and personal triumph for Boris Johnson. You know, he's taken a party that's been in government some time and reinvented it. And that's the great sort of Boris magic. He can reinvent a party. He can ensure that he's in number 10 now for five straight years. But beneath that personal triumph is a system that is potentially creaking at the seams, because it's also a victory for nationalists. Nationalists in Scotland, nationalists in Northern Ireland, and indeed nationalists in England as well. So look, the system is going to be under pressure for the next 5 years, but none of that disguises really the triumph that Boris will feel today.
I do want to get to Scotland in a minute, but Robert, it can't be overstated that this is a very different Boris Johnson than people knew like 10, 15 years ago. If you had gone in a time machine 15 years ago and said that guy, the guy who writes those weird articles that he sometimes makes up in the newspaper, he's going to be your prime minister, people would have laughed you back into the time machine to the year from whence you came.
I'm not sure that's true, Joshua.
No.
I was at college with Boris Johnson. I was in Brussels with him as a reporter when he was working for the Daily Telegraph as a reporter stroke polemicist. And in many ways, you know, this was the trajectory he always saw. He is a man above all else, since he was a student, who loves to be loved. He can kind of take somebody else's clothing and reinvent himself. You know, this is why he's talking about being a one-nation conservative to the liberal centre ground in Britain today, but at the same time he stole the clothes of the Brexit Party and won the support of, you know, those on the right of the Conservative Party. So, you know, this is, as I say, the magic. He can manage to capture a broad swathe of British votes right into the kind of Labour heartlands of the North East and of the West Midlands. And yet somehow, you know, he manages to pass this off. And it is a remarkable political feat. And I think whatever you think of him, you have to pay tribute to that ability to kind of reinvent himself.
He kind of spoke to that a bit in his victory speech. You know, before he met with the Queen this morning, he thanked those who had voted for him and his party. He spoke last night, spoke again today. He acknowledged that plenty of people might have their doubts about backing his Conservative Party. Here's a bit more of what Boris Johnson said.
Your hand may have quivered over the ballot paper before you put your cross in the Conservative box. And you may intend to return to Labour next time round. And if that is the case, I am humbled that you have put your trust in me and that you have put your trust in us. And I and we will never take your support for granted.
Dimitri, how much do we think that this is Boris Johnson winning rather than the Labour Party losing? Jeremy Corbyn, who is the front man for the Labour Party this time around, it seems as if this was a very resounding rejection of him, almost as much as it was a victory for the Conservatives.
Well, I think it was definitely both. I mean, as Robert said, Boris Johnson is a guy who loves to be loved, had a very simple message, get Brexit done, sounds a little bit like make America great again, and has reinvented his party. Some similarities with someone else on this side of the water, you might say. But on the other hand, Jeremy Corbyn ran a very bad campaign. It wasn't clear really what his ultimate stance on Brexit was. He wasn't able to explain on a British television show a couple of weeks ago why he hadn't tried to stamp out anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And I think he was seen as way too left, didn't have a concise message he could sell, and wasn't seen as a particularly appealing character. So, you know, Boris ran a very good campaign and Jeremy Corbyn ran a very bad campaign. I think that's what brought the result last night.
Should this have been a layup for Labour? I mean, if they had not been running Jeremy Corbyn, might they have stood a stronger chance, or was this really Boris Johnson's election to lose?
Well, I think what Boris Johnson did was he cleverly, with, again, a simple message, let's get Brexit done. Remember, the UK has been in a kind of a paralysis now for several years over Brexit. I mean, it's day in, day out. That's all people talk about. Johnson said to the people who want to leave, I'm going to get it done. The people who wanted to stay but were sick of talking about Brexit, some of them went to Johnson and said, you know something, if it's going to happen, let's do it quickly. So I think he built a kind of a coalition. And as Johnson said himself, some of you may go back to Labour next time around, but you've come to me now, let's get Brexit done and let's move on. And I think that ended up being a very powerful message.
Nadia, in a larger stance, this is also a European story. I mean, I don't know that the EU is going to be pleased at Johnson's victory because it makes it look like Brexit is pretty much a certainty. There also was a Brexit party that ran this time around. Didn't do much in the parliamentary election. They won some seats in the European Parliament. So this sends a message to the EU leadership as well, who's going to have to finish these negotiations.
Absolutely. And they already made a statement saying that they welcome the results of the election and they're willing to negotiate with Britain, but not at any cost. Saying that, the president already congratulated Mr. Johnson, and he said that they're looking forward to do this, as he called, massive trade deals with Britain. So I think the United States is looking forward to deal unilaterally with Britain, while Europe has to deal with the consequences of that. And I think just to add to what my colleague just mentioned, I think it's not just that Johnson ran on this very simple message. And I think part of his winning is because he ran on this Brexit message, but also because people in Britain has voted for that and they wanted to be done with it. And therefore, I think traditionally the Labour voters decided that they have to respect the first message in the first place, which is we voted to exit and let's do it now and end this dogfighting in Parliament, if you will. So I think he has a clear mandate for 5 years and he can run on a strong agenda. And then we will see if actually he will manage to get Britain out by the 31st of January.
One of our listeners asked, how long till Scotland votes for independence and troubles begin again in Ireland? How much of an influence did untruthful Facebook ads play in the Tory victory? A few questions there. Let's pull that apart, starting with Scotland. The Scottish National Party, which is pro-EU and pro-independence, also did pretty well in yesterday's election. Scotland's first minister and the head of the SNP, Nicola Sturgeon, says that next week she'll start a process that would allow Scots to vote on whether to leave the UK next year. Here is part of what she said.
This is not about asking Boris Johnson or any other Westminster politician for permission. It is instead an assertion of the democratic right of the people of Scotland to determine our own future.
That's Nicola Sturgeon, who is the leader of the Scottish National Party and Scotland's first minister. Robert, this sets us where exactly? This issue's come up before.
Sure, it sets us on a collision course because Boris Johnson has made it crystal clear as the kind of leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party that under no circumstances will he allow there to be a second referendum on Scottish independence. He is crystal clear on that. As you heard, Nicola Sturgeon is also making clear that she regards the events of the last 24 hours as an absolute mandate for her to pursue her dream of Scottish independence. So it is going to be one of the fundamental fractures at the very heart of the sort of great UK experiment. Can the four nations hold together when they're pulling in radically different direction? And of course, the key point about Scotland is it's overwhelmingly a Remain nation in a way. It wants to remain within the European Union. So as she has pointed out on multiple occasions, they are leaving the European Union, you know, under great protest.
Did that muddy the waters, though, in the election a bit in terms of the issues that matter to voters? Catherine emailed, if the SNP, the Scottish National Party, had not pushed for their interests, would Boris Johnson have been defeated?
I don't think he would have been defeated because he was clearly, his message was resonating in kind of English working class districts across the north of England and across other areas of the West Midlands. That's where his majority was won. So I think in the end, Scotland wasn't the pivotal route for him to get into number 10 again. But it does show that actually, you know, even in his moment of triumph, there are significant challenges. And of course, you know, as we go within weeks of Brexit, you know, the country is going to face, you know, significant trading and economic dislocation. So there are going to be huge challenges ahead, even as Boris Johnson revels in this personal triumph.
Some dislocations that I think people have known have been coming, kind of dreading them and dreading them and dreading them, and now they're here.
Exactly. And of course, which constituencies, which parts of Britain will suffer the most? The very constituencies that voted for Boris Johnson. That's the kind of inherent tension in this victory.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn made it clear he's not going to be Labour's leader for much longer, but he was proud of his message and his campaign. Here's part of what he said last night.
We did not descend into the gutter. We did not undertake personal abuse. We undertook the task of getting a message of hope and justice to every part of this country.
I want to talk about the future for Jeremy Corbyn and for the UK when we continue with Dimitri Sevastopoulou of the Financial Times, Robert Moore of ITV News, and Nadia Bilbasi of Al Arabiya. Earlier this week, you may have heard we did a program where we touched on the topic of Christmas music. You might have heard about Sir Paul McCartney. He let slip that he recorded a secret Christmas album just for his family. Sir Paul told the BBC that he has no plans to release this album. It's just for his kids and his grandkids. Fortunately, he left us a few other songs that are pretty good, too. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Simply having a wonderful Christmas time. We're simply having a wonderful Christmas time.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, Robert Moore, Washington Correspondent for ITV News, and Nadia Bilbasi, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories from around the world. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Dimitri, we heard that clip from Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, soon to be former leader of the Labour Party, saying that he was proud of the campaign. They did not descend into the gutter. I think that ever since, really since David Cameron became the prime minister, the conservative prime minister, and then Theresa May, and then Boris Johnson, people have been wondering about the future of the Labour Party. Is that future clearer now or fuzzier now after yesterday's election?
Well, it's both. It's clearer in the sense that Jeremy Corbyn has said he's not going to lead Labour into the next election. And I think everyone expects that fairly soon he will step down as the leader. The big question is who replaces him, and does Labour stay as a very hard left party, the party that Jeremy Corbyn has kind of brought even further to the left, or does someone come in and do a Tony Blair and try to bring the party back towards the centre in the same way that Bill Clinton did here with the Democrats before his election?
And I think one of the interesting questions that arises from that is whether there are lessons to be learnt from the catastrophic failure of Jeremy Corbyn for the Democrats here. You know, do they decide that they have to fight on the centre ground of American politics? Is this bad news for Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, good news for Bloomberg, Buttigieg, and Biden? I mean, do our countries and their politics live in silos, or are there lessons that can migrate across the Atlantic from Jeremy Corbyn's epic failure?
I think that's kind of been the question in a lot of ways in the last few years, particularly since President Trump was elected. Every election in Europe that we've talked about, I think, whether it was the French election, the German election, you know, Italy, Greece, we're wondering if Donald Trump represents a force that affects other nations, or whether there is this larger tectonic shift that Donald Trump and Boris Johnson and Jair Bolsonaro and other Nigel Farage are kind of emblematic of. Which one is the tail and which one's the dog?
And it's a question for the left right around the world. Do they win through ideological purity or from sort of radical pragmatism and being in the center ground? And it's one of the unanswered questions of our era.
One last thing, Robert, before we move on. Boris Johnson, we look at Brexit on a top-line level here. There are some other more national issues that he faced a lot of questions on, including the National Health Service, the UK's kind of government-run health service. That was one of the big election issues, and he's promised that he is not going to strip it, he's not going to privatize it. He said he wants to build it up.
That's right. The National Health Service, the NHS, is widely regarded by sort of a national consensus to be the absolute crown jewels of British life. And so every party has been promising to invest in it. And that's why, you know, even as he embraced a kind of a nationalist Brexit agenda, he also tried to win the centre ground and Labour voters by also talking about investing in the NHS. So in that sense, he's a centrist. In his Brexit policy, he's going to the right. That's why I say, you know, he's a man who's all things to all people. We'll see if he can deliver. And if the downside of Brexit is economic issues that make investment ever more difficult.
I want to say before we move on, Robert, I want you to know we did not just have you on the program because we have to talk Brexit. I think sometimes as a listener, it can feel like if we ever have anyone with a British accent, they know Brexit's going to come up. I swear we
have British and Irish accents.
Right. I swear we respect you for more,
that's kind of
more than just Brexit.
That's kind of Joshua.
Not the least of which reason being that the UK election is not the only election that kind of fascinated us in this week or the last few weeks.
Not at all.
Not at all. We should talk about Israel because they're headed for their third national election in less than a year. The deadline for forming a government passed on Wednesday. That offers a possible lifeline for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, especially because he was indicted on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust weeks after the last time he failed to cobble together a government in October. Nadia Bilbasi, what's going on? Why is it so hard for Israel to form a working parliament and get to work?
Because of the system. The system is built on what they call proportional representation. So therefore, the smaller party has hold on power. So the Knesset is compromised of 120 seats. So any bloc has to win 60 plus one. And neither of the big parties, which is Likud, led by Netanyahu, or that is new form party led by a former general, Benny Gantz, it's called Blue and White, they couldn't win. Although he won by one seat, actually, but they cannot form the government. And the one who holds the kingpin, if you want to call him, is the former defense minister Lieberman. And Lieberman hates Netanyahu, so he's not going to give him the seats that will allow him to form the government. He wants him out, and that's the dilemma now. And they have not reached what they called a unity government, a national unity government, because Gantz has put a condition that he wants to serve as a prime minister first. So therefore, when they reach a deadlock, basically, the president of Israel has to call for a third election. Now, calling for this third election on March 2nd, it doesn't mean they're going to solve the problem, because we might go again to the square one and nobody will have a majority. But the only thing that's different this time is basically Netanyahu has a serious allegation of indictment, and as you said, for fraud and everything else. So the voters might think twice about him, but most importantly, he is facing a challenge from the Likud leadership. And this is for the first time it might be serious. So the Likud will hold election on December 26th, and Gideon Sha'ar is already said that he will challenge Netanyahu. So now the question for Likud, will they sacrifice Netanyahu, who kept them in power for decades, so they can win next election, or they will throw him under the bus?
So I just want to make sure we're clear, Nadia, about where we stand. The Blue and White Party, Benny Gantz's party, won a plurality of the vote. They got 33 seats. The Likud party, Netanyahu's party, got 32.
Correct.
So Blue and White won a plurality, but they need a majority to govern, and putting that majority together with the parties who want a seat here and a seat there, that's what caused this to fall apart.
Absolutely. The smaller parties, and most of them are extremely religious parties, which Gantz does not want to go in coalition with, or the secular, which is Netanyahu doesn't want to go with. And what was interesting in the last election as well is the Arab parties, which traditionally they side with the left. They were willing to go with Gantz's party, but it was not enough for him to form the government.
So does this make Netanyahu, Nadia, a possible comeback kid, where he would have to, you know, if he survived bribes, this, then that kind of cements him despite all these corruption charges?
Well, he's fighting for his political life. I find it very hard that he will succeed in this election and if he's not indicted by then. But by the way, now, because according to Israeli law, he is the current caretaker prime minister, but he loses everything else, like minister of foreign affairs, or he cannot keep any other ministerial positions. But he has to face a trial. And basically, he's been wanted to stay in government for one reason, not just because of his political animal has been dominating Israeli politics for so long, but because he wants to protect himself from going to jail.
And what does this mean in a larger sense, Nadia? I mean, while Israel is dealing with this, life still goes on in Israel and in the Middle East.
Absolutely, but also don't forget the elephant in the room, which has come back to the U.S. again to talk about the peace deal. Let's remember that this administration wanted to present what they call the deal of the century, led by the president, senior advisor Jared Kushner. He already presented the economic side of the plan, and we're waiting for the political side of it. And they said this is, of course, conditioned on Israel forming the government. Of course, Israel had election, and they couldn't for my government. And now we're going into our own election soon. And therefore, we don't know what's the what holds for this peace deal. Is it going to go forward? Is it going to be dead on arrival? We have no idea.
So we've talked about the troubles in the UK, the challenges in the UK. We've talked about the challenges in Israel. Let's zoom way out and look at the troubles of the world, or more accurately, of the Earth, with the latest report on the climate. The 2019 Arctic Report Card was released this week. It's a federal assessment of climate patterns in the Arctic. And according to this report, things do not look good. Temperatures in that region, which includes parts of Alaska and Iceland, were the warmest they've ever been. Now, we understand there have been a lot of these climate change reports. Sabrina wrote on our Facebook page about climate change, and rain is wet. I'm done with awareness nonsense. Stuff needs to start happening. Dimitri, is there anything that we learned from the report that might provoke stuff to start happening, or is this just more awareness of the problem we already know?
I think it's just more awareness. I mean, it's more ammunition to people who believe the scientists, which say climate change is real, and there's only a limited amount of time to deal with it. The problem is that there's a disconnect between around the world, voters and political action. And while some big things have happened, like the Paris climate change a few years ago, there's still a lot of inaction. This week in Spain, you have the climate change conference, COP25. And even there, the last remaining part of the Paris deal, which is a kind of a carbon trading scheme, has been very divisive, and countries haven't been able to reach agreement. So this is something, you know, on the campaign trail in America, I spent a lot of time out in Iowa and places on the trail. Voters are talking about climate change a lot more than they were 4 years ago. And yet that doesn't seem to be translating into political action, certainly not in the U.S. anyway.
Yeah, Antonio Guterres, who is the U.N. Secretary General, gave a rather ominous opening statement. Here's part of it.
By the end of the coming decades, we will be on one of two paths. One is the path of surrender, where we have sleepwalked past the point of no return, jeopardizing the health and safety of everyone on this planet. Do we really want to be remembered as the generation that buried its head in the sand, that fiddled while the planet burned?
That's Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN. Robert, do we expect anything meaningful to come out of COP25?
Well, I think it's the question of the moment, is whether this kind of awakening of a younger generation is going to have an impact on policy. And it does tie into our previous conversation about political paralysis in Israel and elsewhere, because we have a sort of scientific reality colliding with the political uncertainties we live in. And so the question is, are policymakers able to, have they got the mandate to enact, you know, significant change that might involve a lot of economic hardship? So these are fundamental questions, and it raises, every time we see Greta Thunberg, we ask the question, you know, amazingly impressive movement that she has energized for a 16-year-old, a Scandinavian girl, but will it actually lead to fundamental change? I mean, in Davos, earlier this year, she went and told people, I want you to panic, I want you to feel fear. She is trying to galvanize this young generation. I think it's one of the unanswered questions whether that'll actually impact policymakers to really have a fundamental rethinking of their own economies.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Nadia?
Oh, the only one who's not panicking is President Trump, who actually said in a tweet that she needs to chill and she has to control her temper as a teenager. So, I mean, the problem with this is unless we deal with the climate change as a national security issue and led by countries like the United States, it's really hard to see how you can get an action on the international level. The president still call it a hoax. Maybe there is some change. As you said, Iowa farmers might be seeing the effect of that. But with this Madrid summit, I think activists walked out of it. The United States trying to avoid even paying any compensation for third world countries and developing countries to pay for the effect of the green gas and the carbon. excuse me. So basically, I don't know if we're going to see anything happening on a very high level if the United States is not involved in it.
Yeah, the president kind of trolled Greta Thunberg and said that she needs to kind of chill out and go to a movie.
Exactly.
And then has an anger management problem. And she changed her Twitter description to say that she is a teenager working on her anger management problem, currently chilling and watching a good old-fashioned movie with a friend. So she kind of trolled him right back. Dimitri?
Just on the U.S. political front, one of the interesting things is one of the loudest messages about the danger of climate change that comes out in America is actually from the Pentagon. Donald Trump is always talking about how important the military is. I remember traveling down to Norfolk Naval Base, which is one of the biggest naval bases in the world, I mean, a couple of hours from where we're sitting, with John Kerry to talk about how in just the eastern coastal region of the U.S., where you've got all these military installations, climate change, sea levels rising are a threat to the U.S. If you look at the national security reports that come out, not from the White House, but from the Pentagon, climate change is always front and center. And yet that doesn't seem to have translated across to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, where President Trump is.
So if the U.S. isn't showing leadership, we should get to Craig's comment from our Facebook page. Craig writes, someone should talk to China and India. So if not the U.S., who is showing leadership on this issue? Certainly China and India play a big role
polluters.
In what's happening in the climate.
See, and they're the biggest polluters as well.
Right. But are they showing – who's showing the leadership here in terms of saying something's got to get done? Dimitri?
Well, I mean, there was kind of a leadership when everyone came together for the Paris climate deal. There was a lot of leadership from a lot of places and there was a compromise. The difficulty here is that developed nations have developed by polluting the planet and we're now comfortable. We're developed. We have our houses. We have our cars and we're happy. And we're saying, but now the environment is a problem. China and India and Brazil and other countries that are still developing say, hold on a second, you got rich by polluting the planet and now you're telling us don't get rich, stop polluting the planet. So there's a kind of a divide between developing and developed countries that is very hard to bridge. And unless you have leadership at the US level, at the European level, it's going to be hard to close that gap. And if you have the still, you know, many people say the leader of the free world in the White House saying climate change is a hoax, well, then how can you lead the world to a compromise? It's pretty much impossible.
To put a finer point on Greta Thunberg, we should note that the 16-year-old Swedish environmental activist was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year. She's the youngest person to be granted that title. Now, she's rejected accolades in the past and put emphasis on climate solutions instead. So what's the next step after COP25? Where do we go from here, or do we even know? Robert?
Well, I mean, you know, you asked the question, you know, who will step forward? And we look to nation states, but actually maybe we shouldn't be looking through that template anymore. Maybe it's a generational movement. You know, we look at the young people engaged in climate change activism. We look at those in America against gun violence. We look against young people in Hong Kong making their point against Chinese rule. And so we realize that maybe it's not a sort of into the nation state that will respond. Maybe it's a sort of cross-continental young generation that will come to our rescue.
Dimitri? Yeah.
This is also one area where industry is starting to lead where government is failing. And just, again, crossing America for political or other stories, it's amazing to see how many wind farms, windmills, solar panels have been built in this country from Iowa down to Texas. These are two huge growth industries that create jobs. And so you have a movement in the private sector to say, well, actually, let's lead by investing in these areas. And if we do this successfully, we will solve the problem another way.
Nadia?
But activism, I think, to Robert's point, it galvanizes people into action. And it definitely brings the issue to the front and center. But I think you still, to be able to tackle the serious issues and to find real solutions, you need need to be done on a level of intergovernmental cooperation.
Much more to discuss when we continue the Friday News Roundup. We will talk trade, got some stories about the World Trade Organization and about the U.S.-China trade talks. Also, this week, the Committee to Protect Journalists announced that its annual survey found 250 journalists around the world are in jail for their work. Can you guess which countries jail the most journalists? We'll give you the answer just ahead. Stay close. Back now to the Roundup with Nadia Bilbasi, Dimitri Sevastopoulou, and Robert Moore. Still time to get in some more of your questions and thoughts, 1A@WAMU.org. This week, the Committee to Protect Journalists announced that its annual survey found 250 journalists are in jail for their work globally. The nations that jail the most journalists are China, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Eritrea, Vietnam, and Iran. Speaking of Eritrea, on Tuesday, Ethiopia's Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, accepted the 2019 Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo this week. The prize is for his efforts ending the ongoing war between Ethiopia and neighboring Eritrea. The committee also criticized Prime Minister Ahmed for skipping the traditional news conference following the visit. Critics accused him of avoiding questions about recent unrest in Ethiopia. Let's move on and talk trade, specifically the World Trade Organization and the concerns that some have that it might be time to say RIP to the WTO. Now, the U.S. has never been a big fan of the WTO, but for the past 2 years, the U.S. has ramped up its attack, kind of playing by its own rules by imposing unilateral tariffs. And this week, Dimitri, President Trump effectively shut it down. What's going on with the WTO?
So what the U.S. did is the WTO has something called the appellate body, which decides whether, when a case is brought, whether country A has breached WTO laws against country B or country C. The appellate body decides if something has been done wrongly or illegally, and then decides whether you can put retaliatory sanctions or tariffs, I should say, on the country that has broken the WTO laws. What President Trump has done has used a veto power to prevent the WTO from appointing new judges on that panel to replace judges who retired this week. You need to have three judges on the panel for it to have a quorum to be effective. They now effectively have one. So countries can still bring cases to the appellate body, but there aren't judges to hear the cases. So this essentially means that for the time being, it's a limbo situation. Nothing's going to happen. There's a couple of things going on here. Robert Lighthizer, who's the U.S. trade representative and a longtime trade negotiator in the private sector, has had disdain for the WTO for many, many years, thinks it needs to be reformed at a minimum. President Trump has more of a unilateralist approach to the world, kind of America first. He's pulled out of many multinational deals, the TPP trade deal, the Paris Climate Accord, etc., the Iran nuclear deal. And so this is the U.S. saying we don't want to be bound by multilateral institutions. We don't want rules imposed on us, whether it's the International Criminal Court or the WTO. And so therefore, we're going to make it ineffective and then do what President Trump prefers to do, which is to do bilateral deals with people, and when there's a problem, to try and solve it bilaterally.
So why is President Trump, Dimitri, the one in charge of these appointments? I mean, he could just appoint other people that he thinks would have a more advantageous view to the U.S., couldn't he?
Well, the way the appointments are done, it's not that easy. You can't just, it's not like the Supreme Court where you pick someone who you like and then hope that they get approved. There's a process you have to go through, and so there are kind of checks and balances. But what he's done here has meant that he's prevented the court from having a quorum. So essentially, it's the same thing. And he doesn't want to have cases brought to the WTO. He thinks it's in the U.S. interest to avoid the WTO and to work directly with other countries. So I think this is the best solution if that's what your goal is.
Robert, how might this affect other nations who are signatories to the WTO, like the UK specifically?
Well, I think considerably. I mean, this is a kind of part of a pattern. It's not an isolated move by this White House. It's an assault on global institutions. And just take a look, which country is about to enter years of tortuous trade negotiations outside of the European Union and might well need a global trade institutions to be functioning really well? well, you guessed it, Britain. So, you know, even as the Boris Johnson-Donald Trump relationship appears to be in fine fettle, nevertheless, effectively, in this decision alone, Donald Trump may have seriously handicapped Britain's economic opportunities in negotiating global trade arrangements.
And now, just to be clear, Robert, the EU, that's one of its primary functions, is to be a trade zone. So does this mean that the UK is relying on the WTO more now, or will, because it's pulling out of the EU, where those disputes would have been resolved with the EU? Or, like, explain that difference.
Well, essentially, as we come out of the European Union, and the new date is January the 31st, you know, we are going to be free to try and strike numerous trade deals around the world, not least with the United States.
But one by one.
Exactly. But that is a titanic task. And one of the fundamental criticisms of how Boris Johnson glibly talks about get Brexit done is there's no possibility of getting Brexit done anytime soon. But what we are going to need is a robust series of kind of global institutions to help us navigate this brave new world if we're going to try and do it. And by sort of handicapping the WTO, that's only going to add to the problems, or the already immense problems, being faced by British trade negotiators.
The other big trade deal that the world is looking for is the deal between the US and China. And President Trump says a deal is once again very nearly within reach. This morning, Eastern time anyway, Chinese officials held a news conference to say that they have agreed with the U.S. on a phase one trade deal. America will cancel tariffs on Chinese goods in phases starting this Sunday, this weekend, when the tariffs were set to take effect. The president tweeted in response, in part, quote, "They have agreed to many structural changes and massive purchases of agricultural product, energy, and manufactured goods, plus much more." He went on to write, quote, "We will begin negotiations on the phase two deal immediately rather than waiting until after the 2020 election. This is an amazing deal for all," unquote. So what does this actually mean? The U.S. and China have had this conversation, Dimitri, on again, off again for a while. We've heard this tape before.
We have seen this movie many times, and we've had previous agreements in principle. The last one was actually in October. We had a kind of a nascent one in June at the G20 in Osaka, only for them to fall apart. Now, what's a little bit different this time is the Chinese have actually held a press conference. They, as we were speaking earlier, they were doing that in Beijing, where they've said that there is a tentative deal. But there's some major things worth paying attention. A, there's no text, which means there hasn't been any legal scrutiny of whatever's been agreed upon. And it's not clear what the deal actually does. So it's true that it will remove tariffs in phases. The Chinese will commit to buying a lot of agricultural produce. But in some ways, critics would say that's China going back to doing what they were doing before the trade war started. They were buying a lot of soybeans, and then they stopped. So the real question is there anything significant in here that Donald Trump has actually gotten that is going to help the U.S., or has he just got a ceasefire in the trade war as we approach Christmas, can claim to people that he's got this great phase one deal, and now we're going to go to phase two, which, by the way, even if they do complete phase one, phase two is where all the difficult stuff is going to be. And if it's taken, you know, more than a year to get phase one, a very simple deal on the surface of it, phase two is going to be incredibly difficult in a year that the U.S. has a presidential election.
With regards to the World Trade Organization, Eddie emailed, "Yes, get out of the WTO. Kill it. It's one of the few things I think that Trump has done right. Winning a WTO court case 10 years after your job has gone to China didn't put a dime in my pocket. My job was never coming back." Dimitri?
Well, I think one of the criticisms that everyone has of the WTO, and this is not just the US, is that the decisions and the process takes a huge amount of time, and that if you're going to have these kind of institutions, they need to be more less bureaucratic and more effective and come to decisions more quickly. So I think actually there'd be very few people who would argue against that.
Now, another big trade deal that crossed this week has to do with Saudi Aramco, the massive Saudi Arabian state oil producer. And for the first time ever, the world has a $2 trillion company. $2 trillion. That's the valuation of Saudi Aramco on Wednesday. $2 trillion was a longtime goal of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Nadia, the company started trading public stock this week. And It feels like a huge milestone for the Crown Prince because he's been pushing really hard to convince the world that Saudi Arabia is not wholesale changing, but is opening up for business and wants to be a world player just like everybody else.
Absolutely. There was a great success, personal success, actually, for Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, because he's been trying for the last few months, actually, to try to trade stock exchange like in London and in New York. All the negotiation with Wall Street banks failed, so he decided to turn it to family and friends, as they say. So he basically looked around at the Saudi royal family and some big investors in the Middle East, and he decided to launch it very successfully to the surprise of many. And basically now Aramco, which used to be a state-owned company, is the largest, most valuable company in the history, probably. It's ahead of Apple, it's ahead of Alphabet, it's ahead of Amazon, it's ahead of five top oil companies combined. So for him, it's a big success, but also partly it's political, because he wanted to use part of these funds, I think $25 billion, to fund his vision, which is called 2030. When he came to power, he wanted to modernize Saudi Arabia, to bring it to the 21st century. He said often that we are one of the largest exporters of arms in the world, yet we don't even have basic factories to do maintenance. We cannot depend on oil, so we have to diverse, and we have to bring foreign investors. So for the time being, I think it's been seen as a success, but we have to wait and see in the next few years. Whereas if, of course, for many considerations, including climate change and issues relating to fossil fuel and also world economy, if it will stay as it is now.
And to your point, Nadia, you're absolutely correct in terms of the value of Saudi Aramco compared to Apple and Amazon. I just did a quick search. At the moment, Amazon's market capitalization, the value of all of its stock based on its current stock value, is about $875 billion. Apple's market cap is $1.2 trillion. So Saudi Aramco well ahead at $2 trillion. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Dimitri?
I was going to say, it's true that on one level it's a success, but there are a couple of points I think worth making. They only floated 1.5% of their shares, so that the $2 trillion valuation is based on if you listed all of the shares at the current share price, it would be worth $2 trillion. The market value of the company is actually much less than Apple right now. The second thing is, it's not really a real price, because Mohammed bin Salman has encouraged his family and friends to come in and invest and not to sell, in a way that it artificially keeps the price higher. So, I mean, most Western investment banks do not expect that it would keep a $2 trillion valuation if it was freely floated and people were buying and selling for market reasons as opposed to family reasons.
Robert, it's also worth noting that in the background with all of this was that attack at the Pensacola Naval Air Station, where a lieutenant of the Saudi Air Force opened fire in a classroom, killed three people, injured eight people. This week, the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. visited the base. The president conveyed apologies from the kingdom, and the fallout from that still continues. So this further complicates the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. How does this factor into all of this?
It certainly further complicates it. It certainly gives people pause for thought about whether Riyadh is friend or foe. But I think, you know, going on in the background is this remarkably successful attempt by Mohammed bin Salman to rehabilitate himself, you know, only, you know, months after the death of Jamal Khashoggi. And guess where the world is holding the G20 summit in less than a year's time? You guessed it, Joshua. Riyadh.
Another story we wanted to hit before we run out of time comes from India's parliament. It passed a bill on Wednesday that would grant a path to citizenship to minorities fleeing persecution from three bordering countries, except for Muslims. The Citizenship Amendment Bill has sparked angry protests in the northeastern Assam and Tripura states in India. Thousands of troops were deployed in response. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi claims the bill will protect vulnerable groups. Critics say it will marginalize the Muslim population while attracting unwanted immigration from Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Nadia, Narendra Modi has been under a lot of pressure for his treatment of Muslims, especially in the Kashmir region. This kind of fuels this, but I'm not sure where it goes from here. This seems like it just ratchets things up and up and up and up and up.
Absolutely. And just remember that India has the second largest Muslim concentrations in the world after Indonesia. So, but this tension has been historically, you know, known. But when Mr. Modi came to power and his party, which is the Bharatiya Janata Party, that came on the back of Hindu nationalists, they always have this agenda of trying to go to sites where it's controversial. For example, there is a site where Muslims had a mosque and the Hindus want to build a temple. Recently, also, they wanted to amend divorce laws that doesn't apply particularly to Muslims, especially in Jammu and Kashmir. This has come again, as he said, he basically said this is a path to citizenship. These refugees who've been living in India for so long, they deserve to be Indian citizens. But as long as they're not Muslims, then they are okay. We can accept them. And this has caused many people to criticize him and saying that this is all will lead to more tension between the Hindu and Muslim community. It's not going to help. He's saying that you know, these countries have Muslim majorities like in Pakistan and in Afghanistan and in Bangladesh, and therefore we want to protect the minorities. Now, this bill has passed through the lower parliament and now it's going to be signed by the president himself. We will see, but again, he's been appealing to the sentiment of Hindu nationalists.
Dimitri, very briefly.
It's worth pointing out that when Modi was chief minister of Gujarat, the US banned him from coming to the US for 10 years, didn't give him a visa on the basis that he had not stopped the deadly killings of Muslims in Gujarat in 2002. That was the first time that law had been used against a foreign dignitary.
One last story that might warm your heart despite all of the troubles of the world. Can you imagine what's happening in this clip? That was the moment when the man who bought Olivia Newton-John's iconic leather jacket from the movie Grease, that jacket sold at auction for almost $250,000. The proceeds will go to Newton-John's Cancer Center. But the buyer said the jacket, quote, should not sit in a billionaire's closet for country club bragging rights. Godspeed for a quick recovery, unquote. After buying Olivia Newton-John's jacket, he gave it back to her. She's 71 years old. Back in 2017, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. On that uplifting note, despite everything else we've been discussing for the last 53 minutes, we say thanks to Nadia Bilbasi of Al Arabiya. Nadia, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you for having me.
Dimitri Sevastopoulou of the Financial Times. Thanks, Dimitri.
Thanks, Joshua.
And Robert Moore of ITV News. Thanks, Robert.
It's been a pleasure.
Our podcast is produced by Miranda Fulmore. Our senior producers are Danielle Knight and Paige Osborne. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.